Nebraska Untapped, the source for everything educational and informational about groundwater in agriculture. If you are an ag producer or a citizen of Nebraska, this show is made for you by the Middle Republican Natural Resource District.
Now it's time for our weekly show, hosted by Heather Disming.
Hello, everyone, and welcome again to this week's edition of Nebraska on Tap. This week, my guest is going to be Jacob Miller. He is a farmer and a rancher there in Culbertson, Nebraska. He also is the owner of Live Wire Fence Supply, and he's going to talk to us a little bit about how cover crops work for him in this watertight area of the Republican River Basin. I asked him about some of the types of crops he's grown, the differences with the cover crops being on dry land or irrigated lands, what he was doing before he decided to get into this, and also some advice for others that he has. So stay tuned for that interview. It was really good, and I think you're going to like it. Let's get into it now.
Yeah, I'm Jake Miller. I'm down here at Culbertson, Nebraska, southwest corner. We are running mostly a grazing operation with some cash crops, but utilizing native range, dry land, and irrigated land. Running mostly cattle. We've got a few sheep we're playing with and trying to do the best we can for the soil with what Mother Nature provides. So that's kind of the game plan of our operation and what we base everything off of.
Yeah, that's awesome. And then I guess if this doesn't work out, a few more sheeps and a few more sweaters for you at your store, huh?
Yeah.
I'm just joking with you. So I brought you on because of just what you said here. And so we would just like to talk to you a little bit about how cover crops work for you in a watertight area such as the Republican River Basin there.
We kind of got into, before cover crops, when we started grazing, it was just kind of a deal where family emergency, grandpa had to have an emergency open heart surgery and was laid up for a while, so dad didn't have time to get all the forage sorghum swathed and baled up for the year. So he put a fence around it and started grazing. When he did that, he put a fence around it, turned the cows in, and within a week, they were unhappy. So that's kind of where the drive for all of this started, and that was back in 2001 that happened, and that was during a pretty significant drought in this area and everything else. So that was kind of where the grazing management started before the cover crops did. So after that, we started strip grazing. We were doing like weekly moves. We learned that really wasn't enough. We had to learn how to balance the rumen in the animals, and it turns out that a three-day or an everyday move is pretty optimal for that. You start going out past 3 days, and you've got about 2 to 3 days of good forage, 2 to 3 days of moderate forage, and then a couple of days of pretty poor forage availability for the animals, and that nutrition plane starts falling off. Then you turn them back in where they've got really good for a couple of days, and that throws the animal off pretty bad. So that was one of the things. And we also learned, too, that the more often we move fence, the more grazing days we utilize off the acre, and the more cover we can lay down. It's kind of crazy how you can get more grazing and leave better cover out there. So that's been some other stuff we had to learn. And then kind of when the cover crops started, I went to school and finished up my degree in beef cattle management at Fort Hays State University. And when I did my internship there as part of the beef cattle management program, you had to go do an internship, and I wanted to do something a little bit different. I heard that Dale Strickler was looking for an internship down by Concordia, Kansas, so I went over there, and he was working for Starseed at that time and selling a lot of cover crops and stuff. So I was, as his intern, I was in charge of working on fences, grazing the animals, planting some cover crops and stuff like that at his place. But that is kind of where we started with the multi-species cover crops then. You know, we planted up to like some 10 to 12 way mixes and some stuff, just a, you know, like a two-species mix kind of depends on the time of year. But what it has done for us, it has greatly reduced our winter feed costs for the animals. And I have not updated this lately. I should go back and look at it. Keep in mind that we do calve 1st of May, so our cattle do not complain of nutrition as somebody that is calving in February or March. But by grazing forage sorghum or a multi-species mix of a good forage sorghum base, we were saving, when I figured this up in 2014, we were saving over $30,000 a year in feed costs.
That's pretty substantial.
Yeah, and that's, you know, a 300 cow herd at that time. And that figure, that was just using UNL rate to put up the feed. That did not include running the feed truck or any labor or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the real savings were higher than that. But that has kind of been the backbone of our grazing program. Feed costs down, that's where the cover crops fit in for us the best. You know, when we plant cover crops ahead of cash crops, we don't grow many cash crops. And we can talk about that a little bit later here, too. But for us, when we plant, you know, oats in the spring and then follow that with wheat in the fall,
mm-hmm.
that's been awesome for us. We've never seen, you know, the ground so mellow. There's more earthworms, more biological activity, and everything else. You know, we've got some wheat right now that we didn't plant a cover crop last year ahead of it because we were in the middle of the worst drought that we've seen in history here in this part of the country.
Right.
But what really amazed me is, I mean, we pretty much planted into bare ground, as much as I hate to admit it, because the wind erosion had taken a toll on, mm-hmm. It was about 2 years prior to that that we actually grew something. So there was not much residue left, and we have not fertilized that wheat. We've got more tillers out there than we need or want, so we're still not fertilizing it. So it's been, you know, over a 10-year cycle of planting cover crops, it's been fun to see what can happen to that ground between the soil biology, the animal impact, and the different root structures and everything all coming together to work. And when you had mentioned moisture, so one of the main benefits we've seen now, if we plant, you know, a forage sorghum mix or straight forage sorghum under a pivot, most guys I talk to are still using in that 8 to 10 inch range to grow that crop. And when we get our well reports back at the end of the year, we've been averaging on a normal rainfall year, I'll preface that, on a normal rainfall year, we're only using 2 to 3 inches of water an acre. So that's been huge for us. And where we're growing that at, we've got deep wells there, you know, in the 400 foot range, and we've got diesel power units running that. So it takes a lot of diesel to pump an inch of water there. And that's been a major savings for us. The other thing we've seen too is I'm able to slow the pivots down. We put a lot more moisture on in one pass to get a lot better soak on it, and there's no runoff. So that's been really awesome for us to see too. And on the dry land, it really soaked in. The first year that we planted a cover crop, some neighbors had a field that was heavily tilled. We got a big rain event. The water ran across the road into where we had an oak cover crop planted, and nothing made it through that field. All the water stopped and soaked in there. And that was the first year we had planted a cover crop on there, a true multi-species cover crop. It had been grazed in the past. So we already had some stuff at play. It was pretty eye-opening to see that firsthand. So that's kind of how we got started and what our experiences are with the moisture use.
Right. And it's really interesting until an event like that happens, you don't really understand the benefits, and then you see it and you're like, it happened, guys, really.
Yeah. And honestly, last May, we got our big rain. We've got one pasture we've been rotationally grazing since the, you know, 2005 time frame, and we've kept adding more paddocks. There's about 1,200 acres there with 32 permanent paddocks in it now that we rotate through. You know, last year we got 5 to 6 inches of rain in about 6 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out there the next day and you could have drank the water that was standing in the pasture. There was still water standing in the bottom, but 5 years before that, we had a similar rain event, not quite as much. It wiped out fences, everything. We didn't lose a fence, and that was coming off of a bad drought. So just, I was speechless and just kind of sitting there in awe. Once you really do see it firsthand, it got really frustrating during the drought, thinking you were going backwards, and then you finally saw the fruits of your labor. So that was a pretty awesome feeling.
Well, yeah, and especially where, you know, now you can, like, see the results. The roots are there to help brace for any of that. And then the water clarity, because you didn't have all that runoff. And you do rotational crop grazing on that. Is there like a certain area that you do, and then you move a fence every week, you said, right?
We were doing weekly when we started. Now we're down to everyday moves, or every 3 days.
And you move the fence every time you move them?
Yep, on the crop ground. In the native range, we've got permanent cross fences in. Mm-hmm. So
That's just interesting on that. I mean, I know you move a livestock tank. I just didn't realize that you can also move the fence along with that to make sure that they're only in one grazing area.
Yeah, and it sounds like a lot of work, but the stuff we use, we've got some geared reels, and it's a polywire, so it looks like twine almost, but it's got stainless steel and copper metal filaments that go through it. And on the front of my side-by-side, I've got a rack rigged up to hold that so I can wind it up with a cordless drill.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so if we've got 200 cattle in a group, I mean, it takes me 20 minutes a day to go move them.
Wow.
It's hard for people to grasp, but honestly, it takes me less time to go move fence than you can hardly warm up a tractor and a feed truck and all the equipment you need to feed stuff during the winter. That's to put that into perspective, I guess.
Yeah, no, I mean, it really does. And then with your mixes that you have for the cattle, you said it's great for the nutritional aspects of their diet. Is there any point in time where you've been able to, like, maybe say, hay that area instead of graze it?
Yeah, so after the drought last year, we had some wheat that was pretty well failed. So we just no-tilled some oats into it, and we ended up, I mean, we only put 32 pounds an acre on, and we ended up with, you know, oats that was almost chest high. Hay reserves were out, so we did go ahead and hay that.
Mm-hmm.
So there are times that we do hay stuff, and on the flip side of that, if there's a poor producing spot in the field, even though we don't feed much hay, you know, we might go just open up kind of a junk bale in one of those spots so the cattle don't want to eat much of it, and replace a lot of residue in an area at one time to increase that nutrition and help even out a field too. So we kind of use the hay cycle both directions.
Yeah, and it's also nice to see that you don't have to put as much water into that effort. I feel like a lot of people think that a cover crop would take a lot of extra water, and especially if they're reserving that water for a certain crop, you know, they have a tendency to not even want to do it because of that.
Yeah. The field that we hayed this last summer goes around my house, and even though we've practiced a lot of soil health principles on that field, I mean, it's been grazed for the last pushing on 20 years and only had two cash crops come off of it in that time. And as soon as we hayed it and took all the residue off, water was instantly running again. Tried washing our road out and stuff, so we were kind of sick over that, honestly. And then we had some wind erosion and stuff too that you could see moving it. So we had the opportunity to hay it, but I'm still a firm believer that it is cheaper to buy hay elsewhere and import nutrients than to take it off your own place.
You saw the water start running instead of just standing.
Yeah, that was, it caught me off guard to see it change back that fast, because the only thing different we did in our rotation was take hay off, and we were right back to where we started. There's still good soil structure under the soil, but it definitely looks like it took a toll on the biology and stuff for a little bit, so we'll have a little work to get that back into shape, but the ground was not in the best shape we've ever had it during the drought either, so that was a couple of years prior to that were damaging as well. There's some things at play, but it was a good reminder that if you quit for a year, you can go right back to where you started very quick.
Yeah, that is very interesting to know that you've been able to find that out through experience. Some people would think that it would take longer, or worry that it would take longer, I should say. So what were you doing? Well, you kind of covered that a little bit, what you guys were doing before cover crops. What is some of your advice to others when it comes to objections that they give you on wanting to do their own cover crops, such as, I guess, like working with your NRCS or on their programs? Or
yeah, so some of the things that I hear, and one thing that I've cautioned people to with NRCS, there is a great resource out there to get funding and to help with it. And the main problems that I have seen with it are some of the mixes that are required to plant don't make sense in this area out here compared to where a lot of the policies are made back east. For example, I had one customer that the mix he put in after wheat harvest had 80 pounds of seed. And there is no way possible that anything very beneficial is going to come of that unless we had extremely above average rainfall at that time. So normally the species that are in those mixes are good, I think. The seeding rate's plenty high, in my opinion. The other thing that I hear from a lot of people is it won't work here, or, you know, I read this in a magazine and that didn't work here. Mostly cover crops got their start in the I states where they're planting corn that they use drainage tile because they figured out that, you know, rye and other crops like that could absorb the moisture and they actually had drier planting conditions to go into.
Right.
And then they terminated early.
Mm-hmm.
Where here, we're better off to let the plant get more mature before we try and graze it or spray it or however we're going to terminate it. So it establishes a full root system, has more lignin in the plant, and leaves you better residue cover over the field. And then it will hold the moisture for us, maintain it, help soak it in easier with the root structure and everything. The infiltration's a lot higher. So it's hard to sort through what you read in a magazine, what you hear other places, unless it is, you know, done in your area, or think about how to adapt it in your area. So that's been one of the common misconceptions, and one of the things that has burnt people out on it is, you know, trying to do things that weren't meant for your area. One of the good rules of thumb that Jimmy Emmons, he's a producer out of Oklahoma, but his rule of thumb, like on a warm season mix, is 1 pound of mix per inch of annual rainfall in your area. So I trust that's about 18 to 20 pounds of seed is all we want to put down, where a lot of these mixes are calling for 40 to 45 pounds.
Right.
So that's where we're seeing a lot of the issues at. The other thing, too, as far as I touched on a little bit with termination or grazing, if there's a very good tendency to graze forage early. Like for us, when we graze out oats, for example, we let it go through the boot stage, because if we turn out before boot stage, yes, it is better forage at that time, but the animal can take one bite and have that plant bit off at the ground, versus if we let it shoot a seed head and get past boot stage, between boot and doe stage, they don't want to eat the whole plant because there's enough lignin in it. So you've kind of built in a way to maintain some ground cover as well.
No, and that makes sense, you know, because when cows eat, they wrap their tongue around it and give it a tug.
Yeah, and the other thing that does too is if you graze the plant too short, there's not enough root structure there to hold the plant in the ground if it's, you know, if the ground's soft or moist at that point. But when that cow wraps her tongue around and pulls on a plant that will hold itself in, then it starts releasing the root exudates too to help feed the soil biology. And that's when you start seeing a lot of the real benefits. And the other thing that I would mention about cover crops and getting into it, how to use it, you do need to be pretty financially stable before you start down this road too. It is not about profit up front. It's not going to make you a lot of money up front. What it is going to do is it is going to, you know, reduce costs, you know, for, you know, grazing versus putting up hay like we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to help sequester nutrients to hold on to those, so that way when the plant has time to break down and release it back into the soil, keep it in an organic state so you don't have to apply as much. It's very hard to get a real cash benefit up front out of a cover crop at that year unless you rent it out for somebody to graze. If you do that, though, in my opinion, if that was to happen, I would either want to manage the grazing myself if it was my land, or know that the person I'm renting it to understands your goals, that you are trying to help the soil, not just plant a forage crop. And that's when we talk about cover crops and forage crops, there's definitely multi-species forage crops out there, because no, some people don't leave residue after they're done. They forgot about the soil health principles and took every bite of feed they could. Which, you know, if that's what you're set up to do, that's fine. I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but it's very hard to refer to it as a cover crop if you're not trying to improve the soil at the same time. And one thing that I like to remind people about that is, as far as the grazing aspect goes, the bottom half, the third of the plant, has basically zero nutrition in it. All of the nutrition is going to be in the top half, mainly the top third of the plant. So if you take over the top half of that plant off, you're not doing the animals any benefit either. So that's that's an easy gauge to help aid in soil health and grazing management that way.
Nope, it all makes sense. And so that's honestly very interesting to understand.
Yeah, and part of that is too, I mean, everybody has a different goal for the crop they're planting. So that dictates a lot of the difference too. But yeah, that's, you know, we've tried growing wheat and planting cover crops after that. We've had success some years. Some years we've had zero success, just depending on rainfall. Normally we only get about, on the best, 30 animal unit days of grazing out of that during the winter.
Right.
But those grazing days we've got, the feed was phenomenal. We had a protein supplement out for a group of heifers, and they wouldn't even touch it because they were getting all they needed
right.
from the plant.
Maybe we can just talk on that really quick, too, about the time span between planting to grazing that you've noticed.
So I guess we'll kind of start, you know, so throughout the year we graze rye, oats, sorghum sedan, and then forage sorghum. So I guess I'll kind of go, you know, in that general fashion to help make logistics easier of going through the year. A lot of it too is not necessarily a date on the calendar, but seeing what the plants have done if you're grazing grain.
Right.
But generally, we'll start going on rye the first to middle of April. When we go on there, we like for it to be, you know, 5 to 6 inches tall if possible. Some years that's not the case. The other thing that we've done when we graze rye, we do not cross fence it much. Mostly when we utilize it, we are running our replacement heifers that are going to weigh 550 pounds at that time, put them on there, and we just try and allow about an acre per animal on irrigated, or acre and a half to 2 acres on dry land, and they will eat it down pretty short, but we get them off so that plant can recover and leave us residue is how we've handled that. Then on the oats, we've talked about that a bit, but generally we won't go on oats until, you know, middle of June to 1st of July, depending on the year, but we do like to get that past the boot stage and get, you know, around soft dough stage before we turn on to that. One of the big downfalls there is it goes from dough stage to mature very fast, and it takes a lot of animals to graze it at a short time if that's the goal. So what we've done on that is we get pretty big paddocks. We just go through and we just try and get them to basically bite the feed head off and move on. The thing that oats has done for us, that it is very good at pigweed suppression. That's one of our main goals with it. Rye works very well on kochia. Those are our two main weed issues that we have personally.
Yeah, that pigweed can get nasty.
Yeah, so we kind of use those in that fashion to help with that. And then the sorghum sedans, that's probably the biggest one on from planting time to grazing time. Generally, you know, around 70 to 80 days would be my recommendation from planting to thinking about turnout. But I like to have that plant be about, you know, waist to chest high before you turn out. There are some dwarf varieties that have a lot more leaf on them. And if you graze something like that, just try and take the leaf whorl off the top because it'll have 8 or 10 leaves coming out of it. And don't touch the stalk. Pretty much the same thing for more of a generic sorghum sedan too. Try not to get into the stalk. Just take a little bit of leaf matter. But you have to leave leaves on there too for that plant to gather sunlight and start growing again.
Right. I know some of that sorghum can get real tall. Put your cows out in that. You'll be searching for them for a while.
So, and when we do that, we just use the side-by-side or four-wheeler, whatever we're using. We'll pop the path down, and the cows know once they see a path, there's going to be a fence there. They get trained pretty quick, but I have a lot of fences that look like a snake went through there because it's easy to get lost out there trying to figure out which direction you're driving.
Right. So, like, can I get an aerial
right.
look over here? Where am I at?
And then after that, the forage sorghum mix or straight forage sorghum would be the last crop that we plant, or I shouldn't say plant, but that we'll graze throughout the year. So generally we'll wean some calves and start getting on there around 1st of November, end of October. Otherwise the cows usually come home off native range around the 1st of December, and we'll be on there from the 1st of December to middle of March to 1st of April. Is when we'll graze that. So that's kind of our year-round grazing plan with all of the all of the mature cows and everything will be on native range from 1st of April to 1st of December. And then we've got some yearlings around home where the farm ground is that we'll do some different things with, and then replacement heifers and stuff like that.
You've got this down to a science.
And it changes every year. So, and one thing we've done too, you know, you get into the drought years and cover crop seed has gotten expensive over the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
So we have reduced our number of species that we put in the last couple of years when it's been dry. We've just been planting monocultures, single species mixes. But we try to have a cool season grass and then a warm season grass be the next crop. Still trying to alternate that and keep a rotation going. So that's, you know, people don't have to get caught up in a cover crop necessarily. You can still plant a monoculture and still get good results too. So that another thing that I would tell people is if the multi-species mixes and all that are intimidating, don't worry about it. Just plant a monoculture and start somewhere. Just if you start, you can get going. But if you don't start, you'll never get there. So
right, exactly. And sounds like you've started and gotten a lot of information from all your starts. So it's great that you're passing it on to us today. So thank you so much for that.
Yep.
And I think we pretty much covered everything. So I probably should let you get back to the rest of your job.
Yep, that'll work.
Putting some fence in. Well, thank you so much, Jacob, for stopping and talking to us today. I really appreciate it. All right, Jake, thanks again for being our guest on Nebraska on Tap this week. I hope everybody found our conversation to be informative on what's going on with cover crops. Where you're at differs on what you do for your cover crops, such as back east, you know, it's to help take some of the moisture off the land. Out here, clearly, Jake's using it more for grazing purposes. But to each their own, and you always find out what works best for you, like he said. So if you enjoy this episode and want to hear more episodes, you can always go to www.nebraskaontap.com and you can find more episodes there. You can go to our RSS feed. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and you can go to YouTube as well to listen to some of our podcasts there. I hope everybody had a great time with this episode this week, and we will talk to everybody next week. Have a great one. Bye-bye.